Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Rob Hunt coming to you from somewhere deep in Long Island Sound today. Hope everyone's having a great summer day. I'm super stoked because not only is it the final day of Dead & Co tour today, but we're also joined by a person who has made live music that much more fun for all of us. We'll certainly go through kind of everything he's done in the business. But for all of you out there that are on archive.org or on re-listen and really try to get the best mixes of not just the Grateful Dead, but you know multiple other bands as well, then you're very familiar with Charlie Miller's work. And I'm really excited that Charlie Miller is joining us today to talk about all the things that he's done, not just you know in terms of remastering soundboards and audience tapes, but also in terms of what he's done with Steve Kimmock. So it should be a really, really fun show today. But before we get into that, I wanted to say hello to my co-host, Larry Michigan. Larry, it's great to be back with you. And how's your day going, man?
Great, Rob. It's wonderful to have you on the show. It always is. We got lots of great stuff to talk about. And people get tired of just hearing me blab on all the time. So this gives us another good opinion and point of reference for some of the things we're going to get into, including our guest today. Very, very excited about that. And you were able to reach out and get Charlie on the show. So let's dive in. Charlie, a pleasure to meet you, man. So happy to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I'm excited that there's other people that like to talk about this stuff as much as I do.
So Charlie, I got to say, man, when I think about, you know, the sort of the archivists out there, I always think there's not just David Lemieux, but I think there's Charlie Miller. And I mean that in the most complimentary way that, you know, David obviously gets the accolades for being the person that's handpicked by the organization. But in terms of like the taper community, I don't think there's anyone that's got more respect out there than you do for the work that you've done. And I have no idea how you find the time in the day with everything else you do to have remastered as many shows as you have and as brilliantly as you have, to the point that, you know, as I said to Larry, I won't even usually like look at something unless I know that's got the Charlie Miller seal of approval on archive or on re-listened, which is for years, I got my soundboards from tons of people. I had the 30 or 40 go-tos. I knew exactly what I was sending XL2s to. You know, nowadays it's all digitized. It's kind of Miller or bust for me. So like, I'm super, super stoked you're here with us.
Right on, man.
So as I've told you, we kind of cover different shows today. And obviously I was going to pick a show that you did the remastering on. There's no way I was doing the one that didn't. But as we are now a solid, I think close to 50 years, I think we're 47 years past July 16th, 1976 from the Orpheum. A really, really fun show, you know, kind of one that I think we've all spent our time in the Bay Area. So one that we all you know, can appreciate being in SF. But why don't we listen to our first clip and then we'll dive in and start asking you some questions. Does that sound cool?
Sounds great.
Is obviously Stronger Than Dirt or Milking the Turkey or whatever you want to call it. And I picked that one because I don't think we've ever covered it on this show, Larry, of all the songs that we've you know put clips of. And I love the interplay, obviously, between Phil and Garcia. And Garcia is almost playing like a reggae scratch riff on that. So it's totally different than what you expect to hear from Garcia. It's not scaly. It's just kind of, you know, little scratch, like mini just strums on that, which is a really cool sound. But I don't think that, you know, like sort of the Blues Raleigh like era, I don't think Milking the Turkey really gets all that much credit, but there's some really fun versions in 76 and 77.
Yeah, for sure. You know, they created it, so it's out there, and you know, probably didn't get played very often. In fact, I don't ever recall it being played at all at any time when I started seeing the Dead, so pretty much the 80s and into the 90s. But you know, when the album came out, that King Solomon's Marbles, I mean, you know, Phil started playing, I think, King Solomon's Marbles again a few times. And, you know, it's just fun music to listen to. I really enjoy it. And, you know, I get it. It's a little more formal and organized and complicated than the freestyle they like to just kind of come out and jam with. But certainly when they take the time to do it, and this is a great sample of it, it adds a whole other dimension to the show, I think.
It's pretty cool. It's hard to believe it's been 47 years. You know, it's just so long ago. It makes me feel so old.
Charlie, when did you first start going to shows?
I started listening to Grateful Dead in 77, 78, and I started going to shows in 79. It's kind of funny how it happened. I went to I went to school at Rob Bleedstein.
We all
know Rob Bleedstein.
Sure.
We've had him on the show. Yeah, he's been a guest of ours.
Yeah, he was in the same class as my sister, who was 2 years older than me. And he came over to my house with some friends to hang out with my sister and some other people, and then they split. And when he left, they were hanging out in the backyard, and he left this Maxell cassette back there. And I noticed it started to rain, so I went out and I grabbed the tape so his tape wouldn't get destroyed. And I listened to it, and that was the King Biscuit Flower Hour broadcast of 10/6/77. And that was like the first thing I heard. That and my friend forced me to listen to Live Dead, which at the time I complained about.
Sure. We all did the first time we heard
all
it.
All the feedback.
Yeah. It's just like, you know, it's this really long song. I was kind of, you know, get on with it type, you know, music back then. But so 77 to 79 was the formative years for me. But in 79, my first show was November 2nd, 1979, and my birthday is November 3rd. So when we walked out of the show, I just turned 16. And that was just a pretty cool way to start the whole thing.
So you were Midland from the beginning. You weren't Keith and Donna's final days of 79.
Yeah. No, you know, I never saw Keith. Donna was with Zero, you know, so I worked with her a whole bunch of times over the years, and she was even at my wedding. She's just an awesome person. I love her. Wow. She actually sang at my wedding with Steve Kimmock, which is just kind of funny, but but I never saw her with the Grateful Dead. My first show was supposed to be 1/10/79, and my friends just never picked me up and took me, and, you know, looking back, I should really go and kill them for that. That was, you know.
That's funny. Our old co-host, his first show is 2/15/79 from Springfield, which has that amazing Miracle Shakedown transition jam.
That's a cool one.
It's such a good one. And so he always, you know, kind of like let us know that he was the older statesman in this group. Because I think, Larry, your first show was 83. Is that right?
82.
Yeah. And I was 88.
I have right next to me audience cassette masters from those shows that had never circulated, and some guy sent me his tapes, and I just was listening to them the other day.
Wow.
And they'll be coming out soon.
Okay, good. It's hard to find a good copy of that show. I love those shows. It was great.
It's a tough situation. You're recording on right off the water there, and just the wind and just the humidity and everything, it really makes it tough. But, you know, when Joni Walker copied Dan Healy's tape, it ended up being an audience recording. He didn't even copy the soundboard. He just had an audience for some reason, which we don't know about. So it's one of those things like, where is the soundboards, man?
Wow. No, absolutely. It was a great way to break it all in. My buddy Mikey took me out there. We had a ball, you know, ate some good stuff and saw God.
Did Crazy Fingers bust out? I mean, geez. Oh, wait, you went in 82?
Yeah.
That was a Crazy Fingers bust out. That's pretty cool. Yeah, I didn't see it till The Garden in the fall, which was pretty fantastic, but I always loved that song.
So you just brought something up that I got to jump right into. So people send you, like, their masters and just say, like, hey, go to town on this thing. What's your process from the time you get a tape to the time that we end up seeing it on archive?
You know, in the last probably 15 years, I've received, like, no exaggeration, like way, way, way over 10,000 masters, whether they've been DATs, PCMs, or cassettes, you know, and yeah, it's crazy. And that doesn't even include all the stuff that I got from when I got Don Pearson's collection with all the soundboard masters in there. That was a couple of thousand tapes right on its own. It's like, you know, they just say, please, you know, do your thing and I'll transfer them. I'll digitize them and, you know, we'll pitch correct it because, you know, it's analog. Sometimes things are really fast or really slow. And if there's, you know, usually there's a tape flip somewhere during music, even if it's in drum space, you know, or sometimes it's just in a bad spot, you know.
Yeah.
We patch the flips. And if you want your patch to work, you the patch source and the main source need to both be at the same pitch. Otherwise, it sounds like the caution patch from the Live Dead box set, you know. You know, one second you're going this way, and all of a sudden it's just this jarring, you know. But, you know, in all fairness, I wasn't always doing it as well as I am now. I started probably about 17, 18 years ago really getting OCD about making every little thing right. But there was a point where I had so many masters, and I just wanted to just get them out. So I just kind of just got them out. But, you know, it's, you got to track marks, fix levels, whatever it was. Because 99% of the time, the person taping it was usually high.
Right. So you saw your first show in 79. When did you start taping or focusing on taping?
83. Well, I started in 1978. Me and my sister, I grew up on Long Island, and me and my sister went and saw the band Boston at Nassau Coliseum. And I was like 35th row on the floor, standing on a chair, holding up a little Radio Shack recorder. and I recorded 11/24/78 off of WNEW that night when I lived in Port Washington. But I did this spring tour 82 when I had a recorder and I was going to bring it with me and decided not to. I just wanted to have fun. Spring tour 83, a couple of shows into the tour, I was, what was it, UVM?
Yeah, 83.
April 13th, 1983 in Burlington. I was sitting...
Yeah, at the Patrick Gym.
Yeah, I was sitting right in front of the board, and there was literally a chain of cassette decks, D5s, that went all the way around me. That, actually, it was Nakamichi microphones, and this guy had a reel-to-reel, and there was a bunch of D5s patched out of it, and they said, you want to patch in? And I was like, man, I wish I had a deck. So on the way to the next show in Rochester, I stopped and I bought a D6. And taped the rest of the tour, and you know, it's kind of started from there. So it's 4/15/83 is when it started.
And so, did you ever get to the point where you're able to pass off eight balls of blow to Healy and patch directly in, or that never happened for you?
No, no, I would have been. You know what? I would have honestly kept the blow and just been happy with my audience. And plus, I didn't even know. It never occurred to me to even ask him, and that was a thing because I didn't know back then. At Cal Expo in 91, I was talking to Healy before the show. We were smoking. I had pounded pot, so me and him were getting high, you know, outside the taping section before the show. And I was asking him about the sound problems in the beginning of the Vegas show the week before, and he was telling me what happened with Santana's sound guy leaned on the board and messed up some settings, and that's why the delay stacks weren't on and half the PA wasn't on, and it was all this other stuff. And I was standing there holding my D5, and I was getting ready to patch it into my microphones, and he just stood there and looked at me, and he looked at the deck, and he looked at me like he was shocked. Why was I not asking for a board patch? And, you know, it just never even occurred to me that it's just something you can do. And I just went and plugged into my microphones and, you know, now I got the soundboard masters of the whole year, which is funny.
But he ended up getting in trouble for that, like not soon after that, right? I mean, like 92, 93, he was a...
In 93, the two shows in Chapel Hill.
Yeah, the Dean Smith Center shows.
Yeah, yeah, those shows. I did the Nassau Coliseum run on that tour. But I don't know if he got in trouble as much as people say he did. I don't know. I think, you know, I bet at that point, I think they were all probably just so sick of each other, you know, because I know there was a lot of, I always used to hear that there was a lot of complaints from various band members about various things in the mix, that, you know, Bobby didn't like the stuff Healy did with the vocals and felt he wasn't in, you know, this person wasn't in the mix enough or this or that. And then somebody told me that they had heard, they had always thought that because Healy's a musician in his own right, and he's a great guy. And I learned a lot from working with him when we did some shows with Dark Star Orchestra. But, you know, people told me that he wanted to be up there being the lead singer. And I thought that was absurd. You know, I just never saw that in him. You know, why would anybody want to? I'd be so happy just mixing these guys. But, you know, how many, after 20 plus years, you got to get a little burnt of it.
Hey, Charlie, how long are you on with DSO for?
You know, in 2000, I've been friends with them. In 2003, Kimmock did a festival at Hookerville, and DSO played right before us or right after us. I don't remember what it was. And they played after us because after our set, we stayed around for their set. The band left, but me and Ariel, who we were touring, started working with Kimmock at that point. In 2002, we had no more shows and we had the RV with us and the band was just flying home. So they said, here's our itinerary. Here's two all access passes. Come finish the tour with us. And we had nothing to do. We had like 2 weeks to kill before Kimmock tour started again. So we spent a few weeks on the road with them and we called up Kimmock, had him come in and play a show with them. And they let me turn their stage into a recording studio. And, you know, it was just crazy the stuff we got to do. And they even had me and Ariel sit in the next night. They played one of the early April 78 shows where they had the kitchen crew coming out during drums. They played, it was either 4-6 or 4-7, 78. And they brought me and Ariel out and we did a whole bunch of percussion with the drummers during that show. And then was it, you know, we just became really good friends. And, you know, me and Rob Eaton being tapers, we were just always talking about tapes. And he was just constantly sending me dats, you know. I'd come home from Kimmock tour, there'd be like 20, 30 dats from Rob Eaton waiting for me. And in 2006, they played three nights at the Fillmore. And they had Jerry's guitar there, which was a big thing back then because everybody in the world hadn't seen it by then, you know. They had Brent's custom keyboard there. Brent's widow, his wife was there. His daughter was there. Bob Weir was playing. Dan Healy was doing sound. It was like the closest thing to a dead show since Jerry had died. And they asked me to come in and record it. So I called up Betty and I asked her to come do it with me. So me and Betty just, we multi-tracked the whole thing. And I had enough equipment to do Kimmock, which is 24 tracks. DSO needs 48. Because believe it or not, they have 24 tracks just with the drums, which is kind of crazy if you think about it. So Betty got some stuff from Bob Matthews. And you know, I was just doing that. Healy was doing sound. And I think it was the first purely digital Healy soundboard recording. Because what I did was I plugged the laptop off the soundboard because it was, they didn't have the USB things back then like they do now. It was a little adapter thing I had. And he had said people had recorded his feeds, but nobody had ever taken a digital out of a digital board. So I made this recording and it was kind of cool. Just seeing how he does things, you know, and it's wild, man.
Randomly, tell me if I'm crazy. I think you and I met in an airport one time because you had a DSO sticker or a Zero sticker on your case.
Yeah.
And you're in front of me or behind me in the security line. I think I looked at you and said, "We are everywhere," or something to that effect.
Probably,
you
know,
said,
yeah.
Did you just come from this place? You said, "No, I was just out with DSO." It was like there's a festival that was happening in that town, but you know, that was before I realized you lived in San Diego.
Oh yeah, you know what? They do that festival. It was Labor Day weekend and they played it was in 2006 and 7 and Kimmock used to bring Kimmock's band in there. And this is when Mark Caron had to leave Rat Dog to deal with his cancer and Bob Weir, we're in the middle of Zero Tour. And Bob Weir called up Kimmock and said, "I need you to come play some shows." So one day I would be on Zero Tour with Kimmock and the next day I'd be on Rat Dog Tour with Kimmock. And we were just bouncing back and forth. And in the middle of it, we managed to get a few days off from the Rat Dog thing to finish the Zero thing. And we did this festival with DSO. It was a 3-day festival. But if you got there the day before, you know, when they were setting everything up, they did a whole set of just non-Grateful Dead stuff for the people who were there. And the coolest thing about this festival was on Monday, when everything was breaking down, it was Nelson Lake's Quarry or something, whatever, Nelson Ledge's Quarry. That's what it was. And they didn't kick anyone out. You can stay as long as you wanted. Spend the day, relax, recover from the whole thing. It was like people like us running it. So it was like the coolest vibe.
Nice.
As opposed to Alpine Valley parking lot where they're kicking you out 10 minutes after the show is over.
Yeah. You know, one of the shows I was at this past year with Fish, they were kicking me out of the venue. And I was breaking down my taping gear and the guy's like, "What's taking you so long?" I'm like, "Oh, I got a security guard that is interrupting me and won't allow, you know, if you guys just leave us all alone, we can just get out of here quicker." It's like, you know what Kimmock always says, you know, we're like bees. You just leave us alone, you won't get stung. You know, just we're okay. We can do our own thing. We know what to do. The most of us at least, we know what to do, we know how to get out of here and just, you know, them trying to hurry us up always slows us down.
Are you still working with Fish?
Oh, I don't work with Fish. I did this tour. I'm still with Kimmock. I've been with Kimmock for like 21, 22 years now. But we did a tour in 2006. Actually, we did a show on 420 in New York City, and it was Rhythm Devils. And it sold out in like minutes, and they didn't even announce the lineup. They just said Rhythm Devils, and nobody knew what the lineup was going to be. And it was Mickey and Billy. And it was Steve Kimmock, and it was Mike Gordon from Fish, and a couple of other random people there. And you know, it's sold out. Like I said, it was this really, really fantastic energy. So Mickey had the same manager as Kimmock, and Mickey really liked my recording. So they did a summer tour with this band, and they brought me along. We had a week of rehearsals in Trey's barn. And, you know, after the week of rehearsals, we went back to Mike Gordon's house. We had a dinner party. We listened to some recordings and stuff. And, you know, and we all hung out. And then we did the tour. And I became friends with Mike Gordon there. And, you know, we were talking about Grateful Dead. And he said, I said, what was your first show? And he said, it's one of the five nights at Oakland Auditorium in December 1982. Well, I had Joni Walker's soundboard cassette masters of that run sitting in my desk at home. So when I got home, I sent him CDs of the whole run because I knew one of those would be the first show. So he gets in a car, his girlfriend, it's before they were married, he gets in his car, and he starts driving from Vermont with the CDs. He calls me up a couple of days later. He's in Kentucky. They've been just driving nonstop listening to these discs. And he's like, I realize Kimmock's playing there. Can you put me on the list? So we put him on the list, and it was some festival that got rained out and flooded. So we never got to hook up. But while at his house, we talked about some polyrhythmic stuff because there's some really cool things going on where, you know, the drummer's got this beat going, but there's other beats happening here at the same time. And so, and he mentioned some Fish tune, and I didn't know what he was talking about because I was not into Fish, just no clue. And he goes, you don't know Fish. I said, I'm standing in the guy's kitchen. I'm like, oh, I'm so embarrassed. I'm like, no, I tried it. You know, I don't get it. And he said he understood that. And he's, you know, if you ever want to go to a show, you know, I just saw my 100th show this past April. I just kept going because these guys treat me so nice. I mean, they just treat me so well. I show up, management comes over. Are you okay? Is there anything you need? You know, did you get an okay? Was everything, you know, just your taper tickets, everything good? And then they told me about the Baker's Dozen, you know, thought I might like it. And I went and did the Baker's Dozen, and I've seen like almost 100 shows just since the Baker's Dozen. So when I go, I'm friends with Chris Carota. A lot of the Fish crew is was Kimmock's crew over the years. So I just know so many people there. So, you know, they let me put my mic stand. Chris will let me put it in his booth or something. And so I, you know, when I'm taping for me, or actually I'm taping because my wife says I need to tape because there's a lot of people out there that want to hear my recordings, so I should at least do it for them, for the community. My wife's a taper too, by the way, I should mention.
That's awesome.
So, you know, I kind of do the Fish thing. It's a me thing, you know. I'm not looking to work for them. It's just kind of, you know, yeah.
So when you get tapes, when someone sends you a master and says, or sends you, you know, whatever it is you get in the mail, what's your process to take that and make it sound infinitely better, which you've done for, you know, thousands of recordings?
It's a lot of people think that it's a lot of like the soundboards that, you know, there's something I'm doing that's making it better. 99% of the time is I have a better source tape to start with, you know, where I'll have the actual cassette where I can do a high resolution transfer instead of some old DAT that was done on someone's shitty DAC, you know. I'll align the head with the, I'll do the azimuth adjustment. I have a Nox CR7A. A couple of years ago, got the Nox for $2,300. This thing looks so new. And it's kind of crazy that now they're going for like $3,000, these Nox. But, you know, the CR7A has got the most natural sound. And it's also that pitch correction really makes things sound more accurate. Balancing the levels, and it's the converters in my rack, the Tascam DSD recorder. It's just the clarity is just insane. It's got a sample rate of 5.6 million as opposed to 44,100 of a CD, you know. So it really, DSD is the only digital format that will capture that analog warmth. And even when I'm dumbing it down to CD quality or 2496, you can still hear the difference.
That's super cool. Yeah, I've always wondered because, you know, I think my belief that, you know, David Lemieux is to the actual soundboard of the Grateful Dead what you are to the taper section.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, he's doing a great job. You know, there's a lot of people who have made some comments on my torrents that they wish that I had that job. Well, I'm glad I don't, because if you think about it, if I worked for the Grateful Dead, do you think I would be able to put out all these soundboard masters?
Right.
You know, yeah. it's it's you know, they went, you know, it's one of those things. I worked for the Grateful Dead Sirius radio channel doing mastering of shows for them when they first launched. David Gans had hooked me up with that thing, but, you know, that stopped. There's been a lot of times I've been contacted by somebody saying, hey, we're putting out this Grateful Dead box set. Do you have a patch source? So like I think it's 5777. There's a real flip in, I want to say Around and Around. So that's that patch I had. I sent them the patch and they liked it. And they asked if they can get the original tape. So I referred them to Matt Smith, who had the original tape, so they can do a high resolution transfer of it. So, you know, like they contacted me for the October 78 Dix picks to see if I had a patch for that brutal cut in Stella Blue from 10/21/78, which I didn't, but apparently Rob Eaton has one now.
I've never considered that that's the way these things go down. You go around going, okay, who's got that patch, who actually has one decent section that we need to put in? And by the way, Rob Eaton lived right down the street from me in Edwards, Colorado. He and I would have drinks all the time together at the Crazy Mountain Brewery. Yeah. So shout out to Rob and Crazy Mountain. Really good guy.
He's a great guy. He's truly, truly a great guy. Yeah, it's, you know, Bob Menke is a person who has a lot of tapes that they check with. And the thing is, they know a lot of the band members and the crew members or the family or the office people or the management. A lot of their tapes have worked their way back to me. You know, and like the sound company, you know, Don Pearson from Ultrasound, you know, like I said, there was thousands of Grateful Dead cassette masters in there. And I offered them back to the vault after I was done transferring them. I contacted David Lemieux and I told him, here's the list of the videos, here's a list of the audio stuff and the digital stuff and the other things. And they had just gotten the Betty reels back, thanks to Rob Eaton, you know, like within the previous year. And they were like so focused on that, they didn't care at all about the stuff I had. So I just put it all out, you know, because it needed to be done.
That's a great segue into our next audio clip, Dan Humiston, because, you know, Bob Menke, I think, was the original recording of what we're listening to today before you remastered this one. And kind of coinciding with the final day of Dead & Co. tour today, I was kind of thinking to myself, how many different people have actually played with this band? And how many different people have been involved with this band? You just named a whole bunch of people on the sound side. So let's get a quick clip of the playing the band reprise.
Awesome.
What do you think, Larry?
Good stuff. Love it. Who doesn't like a good playing of the band?
I love the reprises from that era because the sort of the really mellow, slow jam that would lead into it before they came back in was like a build up of like 2 or 3 minutes before they actually popped it back in to play the reprise. And I thought that was in later years, it basically was just come thundering back in without really much of a build. But in 76, it was a much, much slower build up to the reprise.
I love the reprise. That's such a, you know, good part of it all. And, you know, as I tell my kids, there was a play prize before there was a tweet prize. So,
yeah, absolutely. That's what I try to tell them. But,
right. I mean, I love Fish. I'm going to go see him in Chicago. Just got me my too. Tickets. So, oh, you'll be here. Great. Well, we'll have to hook up.
I'm taping the whole tour. I'm taping the garden shows. I'm taping Dix and I'm taping the whole fall tour.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent. Well, good. We'll love to see you in Chicago. That'll be fun.
Right on.
So let's talk about Dead & Co. Final night tonight of this tour. You know, I don't think any of us here think this is the last Dead & Co. show, but, you know, this is the official end of an era. And there's a lot of speculation on what the final tune's going to be. I'll put it out there that I think Ripple's probably the most appropriate, but I don't know what your thoughts are on what they're closing with. But, you know, is this band going to keep playing together? Is this band, you know, like Jay Lane seems to have stepped in where Bill left off? And, you know, what do we think is happening here? And what do you think the final song will be tonight?
Yeah, I think they're definitely going to play more shows. I mean, they didn't say it's the final show. They said it's the final tour. Right. And like Mickey said, this isn't the final anything, but I can't see. I understand these guys are old. We're old, but these guys are older than us. And I understand that, but I can't see them stopping. I mean, this is telling Mickey Hart to stop drumming, you know, for, you know, live audiences. I can't see that. Or Bob Weir to stop. You know, I have a feeling we'll be seeing more local stuff, like how Phil does a lot of that Terrapin Crossroad type stuff. You know, I have a feeling there'll be a lot more of that, maybe some Warfield stuff, which would be nice. But I got a prediction about what I think the final thing might be, you know, and it was, I thought like a Ripple, not fade away Ripple, something like that. But I was just talking about these other songs I was thinking that, you know, would be so great for this final show, stuff like New Potato Caboose, some of the really old stuff, you know, Alligator, you know.
Viola Lee.
That would really be sticking it to Phil, though, to play New Potato Caboose, right? I mean, I was thinking they would just do Box of Rain again. They've already got experience with that one.
Yeah. Except hard to do Box without Phil there, right? I mean, like, I was thinking the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, what about...
It's hard.
They could do Addicts, though. That's the last one they played at Soldier Field in the reunion shows.
It was.
Yep.
It was, yeah. And Box, obviously, was the last one they played in 95, you know, for the final Grateful Dead show.
Yeah.
But, you know, kind of think where they are now. The other thing I was thinking would be The Wait, because it allows all of them to sing.
That's a good point. And, that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, the real question is who's going to be on stage with them at that time, I think.
That is a good question.
You know, that's a good question. That really is. That really is. I don't know. I don't think there'll be any guests. I really don't.
Well, the only guest they've had this whole tour is Dave Matthews for four tunes, right?
That's pretty big.
Yeah.
That's coming in playing hard. I like nothing wrong with that. I've listened to that stuff. That's pretty cool stuff.
Definitely is. But, you know, look, I never thought Dead & Co was going to last more than 2 years, much less eight. You know, the fact that we're still doing this is pretty amazing to me. The fact that, you know, we actually have had, you know, three guys stay until this tour, you know, and losing Billy was, you know, kind of a blow, but.
Yeah. Charlie, I got to ask you about that. Creative differences. They played together for 50 years. This is their sixth or seventh year of playing as Dead & Co. They announced this is the final tour, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there's creative differences?
Hey, I don't believe the creative differences thing. You know, I've heard people say things that I don't know if they're true, so I would hate to even repeat them as speculation. Okay. But, you know,
that's fair.
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I'm shocked by it, quite honestly. You know, the guys have lasted so many years.
Right.
And it's like, now you're going to do it, you know.
And then what, a few weeks later, he was playing with Billy and the Kids down in New Orleans, right? Yeah. Either right before or right after Dead & Co played. He's healthy.
I was down there for the Kimmock shows, and everybody was talking about how great Billy's show was, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. We obviously knew that it wasn't for health reasons because he was out there playing.
Right.
It's the only time I've been friends with Stephanie Kreutzmann for a long time. It's the only time I'm tempted to call Stephanie, but like, I haven't spoken to her in 4 years. I'm not going to call up like, hey, how you been? Like, what's up with your father-in-law? You know, so I kind of let that one be, hoping that it would come out. But either way, I hope Billy's doing well. And speaking of people doing well, you know, shout out, I think, to our friend Stanley Mouse, who has recently suffered a stroke.
Yeah.
And, you know, devastating to the community for someone, any time you hear of someone in the community being sick or, you know, sort of that Black Peter moment of, you know, everyone needing to go run and see, but much love and affection to Stanley Mouse.
Go check out his artwork. If you don't know who we're talking about,
yeah,
you'll recognize it right away.
Yeah. I mean, of that crew, I think Rick Griffin, Stanley, you know, Kelly, those guys did so much cool stuff in the late '60s. And I don't think there'd be a psychedelic movement without those guys. And I don't think the Grateful Dead would gotten the same notoriety, and it wasn't just the Grateful Dead, but a lot of the psychedelic artists of the late 1960s, early 70s, owe a huge debt to the artwork of that school of art. So, you know, I really truly hope that that Stanley pulls through and is back doing art again.
We've all had those posters, you know, those Stanley Mouse posters and the Mouse Kelly. So yeah, all that stuff is just
everybody's getting old, man. Yeah. It happens even to the Grateful Dead. Hard to believe, but true.
You know, I sometimes wonder if Jerry were still alive, what would they be playing? What songs would have made their way back, you know? And
you know what's crazy about that, Charlie, is I think about it now that if they were still playing, like The Days Between would be a 28 or 29 year old song at this point, you know? And we still think of that as being like sort of the last of the new songs. And like I joke about with Larry all the time that, you know, the end of the Grateful Dead was really just mid-career now for the rest of those artists. You know, for Mickey, that was like, you know, he's played 30 years after, 30 years before. It wasn't, you know, we always think of that as the end, 95 is the end. For those guys as musicians, they think about it like, yeah, man, that was midway through my career. And so
that's crazy, man.
It is totally crazy.
But think about, right, that Trey is what, five or six years older than Jerry was when he died.
Yeah.
And he's going stronger than ever.
And as a band, they've played 40 years together. They're already 10 years further along almost than the Grateful Dead were when they stopped in 95. So, I mean, like I heard a rumor 2 days ago, which hopefully is now, you know, truly unconfirmed and not true. But, you know, there's like thing going around Twitter saying that Widespread Panic had called it quits, you know, after 30 something years. And I was just like, there's no way that's true. And I fortunately went out there and scoured the internet and found nothing else to verify it. So I'm going to say that, you know, it's complete nonsense.
Yeah, I think that's a fake thing. Yeah. You know, I had something I wanted to say about the Days Between thing. Back in 93, I was at Oakland Coliseum and I got in early the first night and of the February 93. I got in early the first night, got in super early the second night. And when I got in, I had the taping equipment with me and they were sound checking. And they were playing, they played Lazy River Road and they were playing Days Between. And I'd never heard it because they had never played it. And for a second, you know, I thought they were doing Mountains of the Moon because it has that kind of same sound in the beginning. So I'm like sitting there and Jerry starts singing Days Between and I got like tears in my eyes. This is so freaking beautiful. So I'm like slowly pulling out the microphones and the security comes up and just says, come on, man. You know, I'm a taper. You know, I had to try. So right, I couldn't record it, but I got to witness it. And then that night they debuted it. So it was one of those things that I got to see them play it before they played it live. And that's the only time that ever happened with the Grateful Dead where they played, I got to see them play something before it was live.
And that was February 93 at Oakland Coliseum, wasn't it? For Chinese New Year?
Yep. No, that was the Mardi Gras. Yeah. Yep.
Was it as beautiful when they played it live as it was when they were practicing it?
You know, I hate to say it. I had a backstage pass and I spent a lot of the first set of that show. I spent a lot of time that night backstage playing pinball, eating food, watching Saturday Night Live, and doing drugs I shouldn't have been doing. And I was running back and forth, and I was like a kid in a candy store. And I mean, I saw it live, but I was a little bit too messed up to, you know, on certain drugs to really appreciate its full value. But I then went out to the East Coast, and I saw it at Nassau, and that was really just, that really, you know, I really got it then.
I saw that whole East Coast 93 spring tour on the East Coast. I missed the shows in Oakland, but then I caught the Cal Expos, the Shorelines, the Vegases, and then the whole East Coast March tour.
Yeah.
So I got like, of the first Days Between, I think I caught like 11 of the first 12.
That's funny. I saw 44 shows that year. And the crazy part is the shows that I missed were the ones, you know, I live in San Francisco. The ones I missed were most of the, you know, local shows because I'd come home from tour and I'd go off on these whatever. You know, it was a different life back in the 90s.
Well, should we talk any weed at all, or is it today should just be a Grateful Dead day, Larry? It's there's times where we sort of forget that we've got another part of our show, but there we go. So that's there we go. So obviously, Charlie, you certainly haven't stopped smoking weed, and big colas are always a nice thing to look at. Well done, my man.
I think we should because we have some interesting things. We do have one or two interesting things to talk about. Dan?
Yeah, I had, I had stopped for a little while for about 12 years or so where I was completely clean of everything. And Then I just started smoking pot again because it just, it doesn't affect my recovery of other things in any way. I haven't had a drink since December 31st, 1996. And, nice. You know, pot doesn't interfere with my life like other sure. drugs have. So I, you know, I have no problem smoking it. And
we are all
living in California. It's, you know, it's just so.
Yeah, we're all strong believers. All believers that alcohol is by far the more dangerous drug. I don't think there's any question about that at all. So it's, we spend our lives advocating for cannabis and for responsible cannabis use, and that, you know, it's not a gateway. Dumb thing I've ever done in my life has started with booze. It hasn't started with weed.
Everything that I, and my problem wasn't with alcohol. My problem was that after I had a drink or so, I needed cocaine. And when the cocaine ran out, I needed more cocaine or money to get more cocaine. And then that led to other things, which led to other things. But none of it ever had anything to do with me smoking pot.
Yeah, it's
you know,
two scotches and you're like, let's get an 8-ball. It'll last all night. And like 20 minutes later, you're like, let's get another 8-ball. It'll last all night.
Dude, it's, you know, it's just, you know, because, you know, then you're up and you need something to come down. Yeah, it was like I said, you know, the 90s were a bit different for me. You know, I actually missed the last year of the Grateful Dead. I saw 44 shows in 1993. 1994, I saw four shows. And then 1995, I saw none because I lived like, right outside the front door of the place I was living was the entrance to the BART station. All I had to do was just walk outside, get on the BART, and I'd be at Oakland Coliseum. And that was the difference between me and Jerry. He could at least get to Oakland Coliseum in his condition, whereas I was just,
not doing it.
It was pretty bad. Yeah, I mean, the fact that I'm still here talking about it is pretty shocking, but okay. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. We're glad to have you here. You know, yeah. Because your memories are quite diverse for the Deadheads of the world, and would be ashamed to lose it.
Yeah.
Have you ever written a book or thought about it?
You know, there was somebody who was going to help me do that, and you know, my whole thing is, if I put it in writing, then you can't go back and not that you can't go back and change, but you can't go back and add things or explain why. There's just so many reasons, you know, and you know, I would love for someone to work with me on that at some point in my life. But the thing I want to do the most is I want to pass on the knowledge that I have through either mixing live sound or just with what I do with the recordings or all the stuff that I've learned. I would love to share the information with people, you know, and
it'll be a lost art, right? I mean, these days you can record anything, you know, given the modern equipment that they have, but to really understand the art. And I mean, let me ask you this. When you guys would be on tour taping, was there like kind of an understanding among the group of tapers of like who had what spots, no matter where you were? One guy got to be closer to the soundboard, one guy would be up here, or was it just always first come, first serve?
It was first come, first served. Like, you know, what we used to do at Oakland or Shore or any venue where it was, you know, because 99%, actually, it was always a GA taper section, unless you had the floor on the arenas on the East Coast. Sometimes they would be reserved, but then that's another story, man. If taper sets up in your seat and you're not there, then, you know, they're not going to move for you in New York. They're going to send you away. But
right. But
what I would do is my taper partner, he had a backpack with all the gear, the microphones, the cables, the recorder, and I had the stand. And I would be in the front of the line, and when the door would open, I would have nothing to search. I would have a stand, and they would take my ticket, and I would just run. So by the time the tapers are starting to work their way in there, I'm sitting front row, center, you know, at the stand already set up.
And he just... Your partner's casually waltzes in, takes his time, starts screwing things together.
Casually waltzes in. I lived two blocks from the Warfield. And so we went in December 89 and we did the Garcia Warfield shows. And we just, you know, we snuck the stuff in. But we were pretty open about it when we got in. We didn't have a stand or anything, but we were.
Were you south of Market?
I was Tenderloin.
You were.
Tenderloin, right. Yeah, I did South of Market at one point, but I was
South of Market in the Land of Ruin.
Yeah, I was on 6th at one point. I had apartments on 6th, but that was another on 6th Street. That's
right, right by the Thunderbird Motel.
Yeah, that's another story. But but no, so we were pretty open about our taping there for that run. But when we came back for in February 1990, like Jerry played there every month, you know, and February, March, April, and he skipped a month, came back in June, skipped a month, came back in August, you know, it was like, and like in 91, it was January, February, March, April, May, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 nights. And I was stealthing all of them, but we showed up one night in the beginning of the 1990 run and they had the mobile recording truck on the side of the venue. And we were just like, uh-oh. They're multi-tracking, which means there's going to be a live album, which means there's going to be people actively hunting us down. Who's taping? And I got busted in the middle of the first set the first night, and we taped the other two nights. And then we came back for the next run, and we couldn't get our D5 in anymore. So we ran back to the apartment, dropped it off, and right next to the Warfield's electronics store, we walked in, we bought a D6. You can get a D6 in anywhere, you know? And it was just classic how we got used to get the stuff in, but and they used to say to me, "We know you've got this stuff. We know somewhere that you're taping. We can't catch you." And it's just,
Garcia didn't allow taping the way the Dead did.
He didn't care. It was more of, I was always told it was a Steve Parrish decision that, you know, it used to be if you got the stuff in, you were okay, like in the early mid 80s, you know. But then it was kind of it was just a different thing. And I don't know, it was just weird. But yeah, I've got stories on that. Taping Garcia at the Warfield, man, I got like a million stories on that one. That was quite the adventure.
Wow, I bet.
That was my second home for about 4 years. I saw every Warfield show from 92 to 95. And so I got to ask you, if you lived right there and you saw a lot of Warfields, were you a Charleston devotee after the show? Would you go over to the Charleston?
No, I would go back to the apartment and probably smoke crack or something stupid like that. I was fucked up or do blow or, you know, or get drunk or, you know, it just, yeah, I was, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is what it is. You know, it is what it is.
Well, it's the Tenderloin does that to you. I can tell you that you're not the first person that lived in the loins that was hitting it hard in those years.
Well, that last drink that I ever had on December 31st, 1996, I was at a hotel on 6th Street across from Market, across from the Warfield there. And it was New Year's Day and I had no money and it was raining and I got kicked out of the, I had a $20 room. It was a mattress on a floor and a broken window and a blanket. It was the bottom of the barrel. They didn't get any worse than this. And getting kicked out of there for, you know, yeah, that was my rock bottom.
Okay.
You know,
good for you, man.
Made some decisions and acted real quickly on them. But
yep, which sometimes is all you have to do is realize like that's it. I'm done. If I don't pull it together now, like I'm dead next week.
Yep. It was pretty bad.
Well, as Larry said, man, stoked you're still with us because everything you've done since then is nothing short of spectacular, man. So just like kudos to you.
I'm really trying to give back to the community. Thanks. I really appreciate that. I really want to give back to the community because I felt like I was draining the energy and the life out of everything around me. And I was not a positive person, you know, just due to my addiction. And I just kind of really wanted to make up for all that negative shit that happened. You know, and we all love music. And honestly, I kind of started doing it for me. Like I started getting these tapes and be like, okay, great. I can have these great copies. And then I started saying, hey, is it okay if I release some of these? And sometimes it's, I don't care what you do. And sometimes it's no answer because if they give me permission, then they've kind of, if you give permission in an email and you've set policy, because there you says in this email that it's okay to do this thing, which means everyone can now do it. And so a lot of times they would just not respond to me. So it's, you know, I've had a few conversations with some of the people from GDP or even David Lemire or anybody. It's just like, it was me sending them an email and I didn't get a response and that's perfect. That's all I, you know.
Right. I asked. So. Yeah. So
I asked.
So how'd you get the gig with Kimmock? I mean, because Kimmock obviously, I shouldn't say obviously, but reputationally, Kimmock is kind of a prickly person to work with, and you know, a lot of people are like you.
It's, you know what? It's, he's the nicest freaking guy. He's the only artist that I've ever worked with in my decades long career that will stand up for his crew. If I'm at a venue and the venue wants to charge me $50 for a board feed, he won't start until they give me the board feed. He'll say, show me in the contract where it says, and he'll say, you know, it's, he will actually, I've had other bands be like, deal with it. We don't care. If you can't do it, then don't record for us. You know, it's like one of those things. And he told me that, like, when he was in the other ones, he used to ride on the bus with the crew, not the band. He loves his crew so much. He's the nicest freaking guy. And it's just, he used to sit facing the band instead, you know, with his back to the crowd, just for whatever reason. And people just took it in the absolute wrong way. And let me just dispel the heroin thing. That's just never happened. That's just not even a thing. People thought he was, because he's a quiet, shy stoner, whatever.
Right. Yeah. So that's my personal experience with him. I've, you know, had the chance to interact with him quite a bit when I've been running point on festivals that he's been playing at, and I've been sort of his like artist relations, like liaison. In my experience, he's always really nice, but I also get the sense that like he's kind of like he wants to get from point A to point B without a lot of chit chat in between, unless like you're a person he really wants to talk to.
That's so it. It's like, you know, it's, can you take care of this or do I need to do this? And it's not in a bad way. It's like when we go out to eat and their check comes, it's like, do you guys got this or should I cover it? And it's not, do we have to, let's not sit around for 10 minutes and discuss it. Let's just do it, you know? And it's a positive thing. And, you know, me and Ariel started following Steve Kimmock together. And in 2002, we went to every show for a whole year.
It was zero.
The only shows that I missed were Japan. For four nights.
Okay.
This was Steve Kimmock band. And it was Alfonso Johnson was on bass and Rodney Holmes was on drums. And it was just the most amazing shit ever. And I mean, I lived in San Francisco. They were playing a 75-minute festival set outside of Atlanta. And I flew to Atlanta for this set just to be there. And, you know, one day, Steve called me up. Called me and Ariel, and we were freaking out. Kimmock's calling us up. He's like, we love this recording you made. We want to make this our live album, you know, an actual album out of it. And is it okay? And I was like, oh my gosh. So show up every night. Eventually you're going to start getting paid. It's one of those things. So every night we were there and I became his recording engineer, his sound guy, his road manager, his driver. I mean, stage crew, anything, whatever's needed. Whatever capacity, and plus I've been his archivist for 22 years now, but whatever capacity they need me is how I'm there, but I'm always recording. I never show up without the mics and the recorder. So it's recording and whatever else needs to be done. Help count in the merch, because I love counting stuff. I'm a numbers guy, you know.
So I think Larry and I have said this a lot with some of our guests on this show. Like, we get done with the taping a show and we're like, that was the coolest guy in the world. Yeah, like you've done so many fun things in this industry and with really, really fun people. And what a unique perspective and amazing way to be able to recount everything that's gone on, you know, in the last like 30 years. But as I said, like nothing speaks greater than kind of the volume of work you've put out for the rest of us to enjoy. So it's just, you know, again, a lot of reverence here on this side of the video feed of, you know, I hope you keep doing it, man. Like, cause the community needs you.
It's fun, dude. I'm just having fun. You know, we were on Rhythm Devil's tour. We were staying at this bed and breakfast in Vermont between rehearsal days. And we, after one rehearsal and everyone back to their rooms, me and Kimmock were in the lobby and there was this tall mannequin with like the shirt and the sweater and the golf club. Cause I mean, we're in a bed and breakfast in Vermont. So it was that whole look. So I looked at Steve, he looked at me, we didn't even need to say anything. We put this thing on the luggage cart and we wheeled it to Mickey Hart's room and we put it right in front of his door, knocked on the door and just took off. And it's just have fun, man. It's just, whatever you're going to do, just have fun doing it, you know? And that's one thing I like about Steve is he's never, He's never tried to change me. He's tried to teach me and train me. And if there's somebody there who has worked with him in the past who he thinks can teach me something, he'll bring me over them and he'll introduce me to them and just let the conversation happen. Because I'm so eager to learn anything about, you know, with this working with sound and audio and doing live sound. I love recording, and I'm a recording engineer first and foremost, but my happy place is doing sound for Kimmock. That is just like one of the most fun things ever.
Great place to be.
You know,
that's really great.
And I mean, he had a great band before the pandemic, and that just screwed up so many things for the music industry. And that was so sad. All these bands, like, you know, what are you going to do? Because you can't tour. And we lost a couple of band members to Dead & Company. So, you know,
that happens too.
Maybe he'll get O'Teal and Jeff back. But no, Steve's now playing in O'Teal's band, which I think is fantastic. I love O'Teal. He's one of the nicest guys. He's out of any bass player I've ever mixed, he was my favorite. It's like, you seriously, you don't need to do anything except turn up the volume. It's just that tone he has is so beautiful.
He's great. I loved him with the Allman Brothers, love him with Dead & Co., love him everywhere he shows up.
I never saw him with the Allman Brothers. I've heard the recordings, but I never got to see him.
I loved him with Like a Road at the Warfield. You know, that was such a fun lineup, sort of the Garcia Birthday Band.
That looked like fun. If I had lived in San Francisco, I would have been there. I recorded over 300 shows in San Francisco in 2001 when I lived there. You know, and I was sober a few years, and I was just every night going to see somebody and taping, you know, and there's no shortage of music there, that's for sure.
Well, the good news for me, Larry, is that Charlie lives right down the street from me in San Diego, so when I get back out to the West Coast, I'm quite certain we'll bump into each other at the Belly Up or some other venues around the area.
For sure, bro.
But it sounds like you might get a chance to meet him in person for Fish in Chicago, so... part of the great thing about us doing this show, besides you know, the fact we just get to nerd out about the Grateful Dead for an hour every Wednesday, is the people we have gotten to meet and how many people we've actually kept in touch with afterwards, whether it's Rob Bleedstein or David Gans or some of the other ones we've mentioned. But it's been a really, really unique way to sort of, you know, meet new friends on this very limited venue of a small audience podcast we have. But, you know, thank you.
Yeah, David Gans is a great guy. You know, David Gans is responsible for
very nice.
Helping me. I mean, he introduced me to a lot of people, and it's like, I don't know how to phrase it properly, but it's like, you know, he's responsible for introducing me to a lot of people who got me a lot of tapes over the years. And, you know, David Gans' contribution to our scene is just, you know, immeasurable. It's just so, so unbelievably big. And we're lucky to have him.
And it's such an understated way. And he's the most humble and gracious person in every possible way. The guy's just chill, laid back, and really kind to everyone that he comes in contact with.
Such a nice guy.
We're very big fans. So, hey, Charlie, you've been super, super gracious with your time today, man. And obviously, you know, we'd love to have you back. Anytime you want to spend another hour with us, you know, you've got carte blanche and open invite to come back and share more stories.
That would be great. I would love to, you know, come back sometime. We could talk set list patterns and discuss, you know, we can do a retrospect, look back at the Dead & Company tour and look back and after it's all done. And
so, Larry, before you sign off, you didn't give your prediction for what you think the final tune is going to be.
Yeah, they're just such a, the stuff they pull out of nowhere, right? And look, the interesting thing about Dead & Co. is that, you know, set list order means very little to them. And right. And songs just pop up everywhere throughout the set, which is kind of cool because it keeps it, you know, a little more unpredictable. But in that regard, it's more a stab in the dark. I mean, it seems that the way that they've been, you know, ending their really big shows has been with Ripple. You know, if that seems to be a good way to go, but they could certainly do Addicts again. I love Addicts. I don't think that they would do Box of Rain, but Bobby has a sense of humor. Who knows?
Yeah.
Love Bobby.
Yeah.
Love Bobby.
Sure. Absolutely. He's carried the mantle very nicely.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved him during the early 80s, freaking rock star Bobby, man. I just love that shit. Just, you know, yeah.
I can't sing Not Fade Away, get to the Cadillac Lyric without jumping forward and throwing my arms up.
We were at the Scope in 82, and I was leaning on the rail right in front of Bobby Dost, and he just, you know, they stopped and screamed, I'm going to tell you how it's going to be. And he just pointed right down at me and the people right next to me. He looked right at us, and we just lost our freaking mind. And that's when he was pointing over there and just pointing right down. Yeah,
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's always good fun. No doubt about it. Right. Okay, guys. Well, Rob, great to have you back on the show this week. We look forward to having you back as much as we can. Charlie, thank you again. This was a real treat for us. You know, Rob and I are self-styled, you know, nerd heads when it comes to the Grateful Dead. And we love meeting others of our ilk, especially those that are actually accomplished, you know, to the degree that you are with the Grateful Dead and the family and all of that stuff. And it just makes me very happy to know that there's guys like you out there who get to be part of all of this and bring it to the rest of us who never quite got our foot in the door, but love going every time we can.
Right on.
So it's all very cool.
I look forward to coming back sometime and doing it again.
Please.
Yeah. And I'll sign off by saying, you know, thank you again. And it'd be remiss not to do the cliche thing based on the show that I chose to play, but I'm going to play us off with a song that Charlie, I'm sure, is shaking his head, go, oh, don't do it. But I just have to.
No. I just realized it.
But at the end of the show, you know, it's time to edit, so go on home. Your mama's calling you, my man.
Right on, brother.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Very good. Everyone, have a great show. Have a good week. Be safe. Enjoy your cannabis responsibly.